Mr. Paradis.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Judge Garland, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. There wasn't a court in this country, let alone a military commission, that could have tried any of these crimes prior to 2006. And so whether or not it's under ordinary interpretations against retroactivity or in favor of constitutional avoidance, or whether it's the clear and explicit commands of the ex post facto clause, my client cannot be convicted of crimes that did not exist when he is alleged to have committed them. Now, this Court asked two questions that get to the heart of this case. And the answers to those questions are not a matter of dispute. There's no dispute that the ex post facto clause applies, and there's no dispute that none of the charges in this case are war crimes under international humanitarian law. And it's also fair to say that there's no dispute that Congress did not prescribe these offenses at any time prior to 2006. And so what that means is that all the sources of law one can be expected to look to know what was legal and illegal prior to 2006, to know what the law was prior to 2006, all of those sources of law were silent when it came to the offenses in these
books. I don't understand why you aren't arguing that the Military Commission Act is in fact retroactive and fails under the ex post facto clause. I mean, the jurisdictional grant, the definition of unlawful enemy combatant, these seem to be clearly anticipating a retroactive effect. Is it because that you forfeited that argument by not bringing it before the Military Commission?
No, Your Honor. We do make that argument.
You didn't bring that argument before the Military Commission, right?
Well, in fact,
the ex post facto clause argument. That you didn't bring it there.
In fact, Mr. Ballou, at a time in which he was, for all intents and purposes, representing himself, did raise the retroactivity of the law directly with Colonel, the presiding officer in the case. And the presiding officer had a lengthy colloquy with Mr. Ballou, instructing him that his boycott, Mr. Ballou sort of consistently protests that he's boycotting the proceedings and then argues about issues in the case. And so the presiding officer told Mr. Ballou that his boycott would be treated as preserving jurisdictional challenges and legal challenges to the charges. And then, ultimately, when Mr. Ballou entered his plea, he said, "I am not guilty. These are not crimes." And that language was almost verbatim what Colonel Gregory had instructed him was how his boycott was being construed. So while there was no motion filed in the Military Commission about ex post facto clause, it's undoubtedly true that Mr. Ballou protested the charges as illegitimate. And moreover, if there is an ex post facto clause problem, these charges are just not triable. The Military Commission never had jurisdiction. And so it doesn't matter if he raised them or waived them. These go to the core jurisdictional questions of whether or not the government has the authority to hail him into court at all.
But your reading of the Military Commission Act is that it is not retroactive. Is that right?
Yes, and that's what this Court found in Hamdan II. And I should be clear that we're not saying that none of the Military Commissions Act can be applied retroactively. The key to the retroactivity analysis that courts and the Supreme Court ordinarily undertake is whether or not changes in the law are to be made retroactive. And Congress certainly evinced an intent not to change the law. That's I think, the clearest, and that's what this Court's reading of what 950P said. And so the question then is, what do you do with that? Do you presume that
Can't we conclude that perhaps they intended not to change the law, but in fact they did?
Well, that's correct. And so, ultimately, whether it's a function of presuming that Congress did not want actual changes in the law to have a retroactive effect, or whether it's just the ex post facto clause makes that a constitutional rule, the Court ultimately goes down the same path to the same destination, and that is that whether or not it's a function of congressional...
If we were to disagree with you about preserving the ex post facto clause argument, and we're looking at this under plain error, how does your argument withstand plain error review?
Well, even though the ex post facto charges, jurisdictional challenges aren't even subject to plain error. But even assuming
the question here is whether it is ex post facto, right? I mean, it's a tough question about whether these are new crimes or not. Wouldn't you admit it's a close call?
No, we wouldn't admit it's a close call, because even the government concedes that none of these offenses existed in any statute and that none of these offenses were cognizable under customary international law. And so the two bodies of law that
there's this live question about the U.S. common law of war, right?
I'm sorry?
There's also an argument whether there is a U.S. common law of war that these were somehow part of when mentioned in the Military Commission Act.
Well, that certainly wasn't Congress's understanding of the law. When Congress was legislating for the Military Commissions Act, they looked to their power under the Define and Punish Clause. The Define and Punish Clause is the historic source of authority for subject matter jurisdiction in law of war commissions, and they even reference it specifically in enumerating the offenses. So Congress certainly didn't think they were codifying some separate body of a U.S. common law of war. And in fact, until the briefing in this case, no one has ever argued that such a thing even exists. And I think even if there was a academic theory that it might exist, the government still confronts two unovercomable problems. And the first being that no law made this U.S. common law actionable or created jurisdiction over it in any court prior to 2006. So even assuming that's what Congress intended in 2006, there's a jurisdictional vacuum for the U.S. common law of war prior to that. But I think even more fatal to the government's argument is that...
And isn't that actually an argument that's made in Hamdan? Didn't Hamdan limit the jurisdiction to Article 21? And Article 21 at the time was understood by Kieran to be just international.
Well, that's absolutely right. It's the only conceivable jurisdiction and that Congress could be recodifying such that you wouldn't have an ex post facto clause problem would be Article 21, because it was the only jurisdictional grant over war crimes that could apply extraterritorially and give the government the kind of jurisdiction it claims it is exercising here. But I think the even more fatal problem for the government is not just that this law, even if it could exist, didn't exist prior to this case, is that if we actually look to U.S. practice, and we think that goes back to the Civil War, but certainly from the formative period in the law of war, from the Second World War and forward, then none of the inchoate charges in this case are a part of American practice. And in fact, they were rejected at every possible turn, including in the course of litigation. And that was true at Nuremberg, that was true in Tokyo, that was true in the U.S. military tribunals in Europe and in Asia. That was true in Yugoslavia and Rwanda and Sierra Leone, and I think probably most important, or at least most relevant, is that was true in Iraq in 2003. So 2 years after my client was in custody, the government set up a war crimes tribunal to try Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists for war crimes, and in doing so did not provide inchoate war crimes, did not provide conspiracy, did not provide solicitation, or in fact material support for terrorism as offenses triable in this law of war, international humanitarian law tribunal. And so U.S. practice on this, certainly since the Second World War, and for the reasons we've set out in our brief, we think as well going to the Civil War, has never treated inchoate conspiracy as a standalone offense.
First, I guess I understand, I think, the argument that these offenses were not positively articulated in the international law of war. Mm. But I understood you to say that that Al-Balu could not have been hailed into any court, I assume even a U.S. criminal court. Why would not there be aider and abettor or conspiracy liability in criminal court?
Well, I apologize if I was misunderstood. He couldn't have been held into any court on these charges. If the government has evidence to show that he committed some other court that's either tribal in a federal court or even tribal in a military commission, that's the government's
prerogative. Well, you say trial on these charges. Are you saying just the label that they've put on it are functionally what was involved in the offense.
Well, not just the label, what the government both set out to prove to the jury, and what the jury found. This was unquestionably an incorrect conspiracy and solicitation and material support for terrorism case. The government didn't pursue an aiding and abetting theory. The government didn't pursue a joint criminal enterprise theory. In fact, the government explicitly abandoned a joint criminal enterprise theory, which is not unlike aiding and abetting in international law. And so if there are substantive crimes that Mr. Bull can be charged with, and if the government in good faith believes it can prove them, it's vacating this conviction will, A, give it that opportunity, but ultimately it's the government's prerogative to choose the charges it's going to bring against someone. And presumptively they brought the most serious charges they believed they could prove. And here the problem is those charges just weren't crimes when Mr. Bluhl is alleged to have committed them. And I would just sort of then say, and maybe reserve the remainder of my time, is just that my client was hailed into a court for crimes that did not exist at the time he's alleged to have committed them. And that simple proposition, based on that simple proposition, all we ask is that this court reinstate the panel's vacator of the judgment below. And I would reserve the remainder of my time here.
All right. You may reserve.
Thank you.
Here from Mr. Gershengorn for the government.
Chief Judge Garland, may it please the Court. The experience of our wars and the acts and orders of our wartime tribunals reflect a long history of trying conspiracy to violate the law of war in a military commission. That history includes some of the most high-profile and highly publicized military commission trials our nation has seen. It starts with the Civil War trials of Henry Wirz and Leger Grenfell. It includes the trial of the Lincoln conspirators, and it includes the trials of the Nazi saboteurs in both Kirin and in Kolpaw. And in the post-war period, it includes the acts and orders of our military for in connection with the regulations for trying war criminals in the China theater after World War II, General MacArthur's orders for the Korean War, and then in the Army Field Manual, the authoritative guidance from the Department of the Army, and the modern-day Libra Code, which has made conspiracy triable in a military commission since 1950.
So do you think it's clear that material support could have been tried in the military commission before the MCA was passed?
So, Your Honor, we think that that material support could be tried in a military.
And do you think it was clear?
We think that the clear and unambiguous standard is not the standard that we would propose.
I'm just asking, leave aside the standard just for a moment. Do you think it was clear that material support could have been tried prior to the MCA?
Your Honor, I don't think that we're contending that we would meet the clear and unambiguous standard that Justice Stevens said with respect to material support. We do think we need it with respect to conspiracy. And conspiracy
you
really...
You agree it was questionable whether or not...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You agree it was questionable whether or not material support could have been tried.
We think that, Your Honor, the proper standard is the one identified in Kirin, and that it would...
Leave aside the standard. I just want to know how clear this is. Do you agree that it was questionable whether material support could have been tried prior to the MCA?
We think there was a direct analog to material support in the Civil War...
I'm asking this question because both the Defense Department and the Justice Department in the legislative history of the 2009 revisions of the MCA said it was questionable. Does the government have a different position on that now?
Your Honor, I believe that both Assistant Attorney General Chris and General Counsel Jay Johnson said was that there was a risk that a court of appeals would conclude otherwise with respect to material support.
Let me read you what Mr. Johnson said. The question was, for Mr. Larson, the administration, where does the administration sit on material support of terrorism as a chargeable offense in the MCA? Are they supportive of it or not, and why? Mr. Johnson, who was the General Counsel of the Defense Department at the time, sitting with Mr. Chris, who was the head of the National Security Division. We looked at it carefully and concluded that the historical precedent for material support as a law of war offense was questionable, and therefore material support should be prosecuted if it is prosecuted in Article III federal courts. Is the government's position the same?
Your Honor, the government's position has not changed. The government's position remains, however, that we would meet the clearance standard with respect to material support in light of the direct Civil War analogs. But we recognize that conspiracy is a much stronger case. And it's with
isn't the question, you agree that all three of these are not recognized offenses under the international law of war, correct?
Your Honor, we have conceded they are not violations of the international law of war, but we believe they are violations of the law of war. And I think it would help, Your Honor.
I guess the problem I have with that and had last time around on this case is the Supreme Court's statements that the law of war is a term of art, a legal term of art, that refers, as Justice Kennedy said in Hamdan, it is the body of international law governing armed conflict. And you see that in Kieran, you see that in Yamashita, you see that in OLC memos, you look at Black's Law Dictionary from the time, 1909, and it all says international law. And so I don't know how we can, U.S. precedents inform international law, but I don't know how we're supposed to get out of the box that the statute creates, which is that law of war is international law.
So, Your Honor, your question goes right to the heart of the case, and I'd like to address that, if I could, perhaps at some length. To be clear at the start, we believe the law of war is the international law of war as supplemented by the experience and practice of our wars and our wartime tribunals. We think that was the definition adopted by Winthrop. We think it's the definition adopted by all eight justices who reached it in Hamdan, and we think that is exactly what the court did in Hamdan. Let me take a sec, if I could. In Winthrop, what Winthrop said was the law of war in this country is not a formal written code, but consists mainly of general rules derived from international law, supplemented by acts and orders of the military power and a few legislative provisions. What Justice Thomas said in his dissent, and please forgive me for reading, said the common law of war, as it pertains to offenses triable by military commission, is derived from the experience of our wars and our wartime tribunals, and the laws and usages of wars as understood and practiced by the civilized nations. And what the majority said in Hamdan was that the UCMJ conditions the president's use of military commissions on compliance not only with the American common law of war, the American common law of war, but also the rest of the UCMJ itself insofar as applicable and with the rules and precepts of the law of nations.
Statement from Justice Stevens' opinion, the plurality in Hamdan, I read that sentence as saying there are three separate things that you have to comply with 821, the international law of war, the rest of the UCMJ itself, and the American common law of war. I do not read it to say that you can excuse a violation of international law by complying with something known as the American common law of war.
So, Your Honor, small point, I think that is from the majority opinion.
That's the
key point is, Your Honor, we do read that differently, and we read that differently in part because we're looking at what the Supreme Court actually did. What Justice Stevens' plurality and Justice Thomas's dissent do is go on for page after page after page discussing the very precedents that we're asking this court to look at in conspiracy. They looked at the Lincoln conspirators. They looked at Kieran, and they looked at Wirtz and Grenfell. And they were doing so to determine whether conspiracy was triable in a military commission. Justice Stevens' opinion has one paragraph at the end on international law. The entire bulk of his opinion is focused on the same questions we are. And Justice Thomas is exactly the same. What we are asking this court to do is exactly what all seven justices did in Hamdan. And the reason for that is because the alternative reading would risk putting would put in jeopardy the entire 150 years of the acts and practices of our military commissions. The cases we're talking about, Your Honors, and this is critical, I think, for the ex post facto discussion, for looking back to figure out whether there's an ex post facto violation here. The cases we're talking about are some of the highest profile cases. They were reviewed because there was death sentences at issue. They were reviewed in each case by the President of the United States. And the review was a searching one, because indeed in two of the five cases, the President, in both Culpa and Grenfell, commuted the sentence. They were highly publicized cases, and they were reviewed as well by the JAG and the military corps. So, for example, in Culpaw, there was Assistant Attorney General Tom Clark, later Attorney General Clark and Justice Clark, analyzed the COLPAD decision, and these are in the materials in our supplemental appendix, and concluded that conspiracy to violate the law of war was triable in a military commission. And that also was affirmed. The Special Board of Review reached the same conclusion. The Lincoln conspirators, the Grenfell and Wirtz, they were all situations which the President signed off on those things. The consistent practice after World War II is the same. And again, we have the field manual, and we have the orders in the China theater, and we have General MacArthur's orders in the Korean War. The idea that it was that it would be unfair or an ex post facto violation when Congress made the decision, as it did in the 2006 MCA, to make conspiracy to violate the internet, to violate the law of war itself, tribal in a military commission, does not hold up in light of that. In light of that practice. And the cases we're talking about make very clear that they're talking about conspiracy to violate the laws of war. That's the exact language in the Wirtz, in the Wirtz opinion, excuse me, Your Honor, in the Supplemental Appendix 56 and in Grenfell in 53. What they say is it's conspiracy in violation of the law of war to, and in that case, to burn down Chicago. So we think that history is clear, and we think, again, that what we're asking this court to do is not a major departure. Your Honor, Judge Kavanaugh mentioned Kieran. We read Kieran very differently and consistent with Kavanaugh, although Kieran is not always precise. What Kieran says is, from the very beginning of its history, this court has recognized and applied the law of war as including the part of the law of nations which prescribes the conduct of war, et cetera. And so we don't think anything we're saying is different from what the court said in Kieran, although it's, you know, we recognize that that there is a lack of precision sometimes.
The government's own brief in Kieran said that the law of war has its own common law, and this common law of war is a centuries-old body of largely unwritten rules and principles of international law.
And what the government cites, Your Honor, on page, I think it's 29 of its brief, is exactly the site in Winthrop that I cite, that I read you today. It's page 773 of the Winthrop site. And all of the, there was an appendix, as Your Honor is well aware, attached to the Kieran brief. And what that appendix laid out is the American experience with conspiracy in military commissions. It set forth the American law and practice. And it is that law and practice that we believe that the Hamdan II opinion undermined. I think it made the debate that the justices were having in Hamdan, that the plurality and Justice Thomas divided on, it made that debate largely irrelevant. And we don't think that that's a fair reading of the Supreme Court's Hamdan decision.
Are you arguing that there is a domestic common law of war, or are you arguing simply that the international law of war has boundaries that are not exact, and that because it is itself common law and is evolving, that we have to look to analogs from the past in order to fill that in?
So, Your Honor, I would say it this way. The best way I can answer your question is we have conceded, as counsel said, that it does not currently violate the international law of war to have a conspiracy violation of the law of war. However, we do think that the question that 821 poses, even if this court were to take international law as the foundation, is whether, as under international law, it is triable in a military commission. 821 does not say it has to violate international law. And we do think that in light of what Your Honor has pointed out, the evolving nature of international law and the perhaps fuzziness of the boundaries, and in particular in light of the American experience, that the conspiracy is triable under international law, it is triable in a military commission. And there are cases, the most obvious are spying and sabotage, the cases that don't themselves violate international law but are triable in a military commission under international law. International law permits those to be tried. And the same is true with conspiracy. Now, it's not the same level of international practice, but we cite on page 56 and 57 of our brief the experience of the French and Dutch tribunals trying conspiracy. And we think to that end, the American experience is critical and shows again that even if this court were, as we don't think it can, but even if this court were to conclude that law of war means international law of war, the question is not does it violate international law, but is it triable in a military commission under international law? And the American experience, in our view, is critical to informing that question. And
Let me ask you a related question or a follow-up question to that. If I assume for a minute that I was not persuaded that the history of military commissions is sufficiently precise for us to be able to conclude that these three crimes were triable before a military commission. Just assume that for purposes of my argument. I'm interested in understanding what you think the consequences of that are for this case. And in particular, given the statute's very clear statement that Congress intended to create no new laws, doesn't that mean that the statute's essentially unambiguous, that is, that conspiracy, material support, and solicitation as used in 950V can only be prosecuted prospectively?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe that as a matter of statutory construction, we can get to the point where we exclude defendants' conduct from the scope of the 2006 Act, and let me explain why.
Go ahead.
First, I think the text is clear. As Judge Griffith pointed out, 948D makes clear that Congress expected this to apply to conduct that occurred before, on, or after September 11th.
Correct, but for existing crimes.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
For crimes then triable before military commissions.
So
that doesn't answer the question that I'm asking you. That doesn't answer that question.
So
it just tells us that for crimes existing that were triable before commissions at the time on before or after 9/11, that they could be tried under this statute retroactively to people who committed those crimes.
So, Your Honor, let me take, if I could just conclude.
No,
I have
go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
So I think 950P is as a textual matter, is also relevant to this question. That was this situation in which Congress said, we don't believe any of these statutes are contrary to Your Honor's hypo, but that any of these statutes make triable something that wasn't triable before. But if I can, Your Honor, I think the bigger picture.
What's the key? I just want to hear the government's view. What is the statutory source of the ambiguity here? Again, assuming that I don't accept the argument that these offenses were trialed before commissions, what's the basis for the ambiguity in the statute?
So, Your Honor, I actually think the statute is clear the other way. I don't think there's ambiguity. And I think that, in part, the two provisions I read, but if I could also step back and answer that question, which mm-hmm. I hope is a direct answer to your mm-hmm. question this way. Two things were going on that seemed to me critical. First of all, it was clear at the time the 2006 and the 2009 MCAs were passed that Congress was dealing, although it was setting up a system going forward, that Congress was dealing with the detainees at Guantanamo, and that Congress understood that the statutes it was passing was precisely designed to cover the conduct of these individuals, all of whom, almost by definition, had committed crimes before the date of the act.
Right.
Second, I think Boumediene is really dispositive here. What Boumediene said was, when the government came up and argued that the DTA should be construed against the backdrop of constitutional avoidance, the court said, no, that's not right. What's happened here is we've had a dialogue with Congress. We sent back something to Congress. Congress then acted, and it came to us. It's not responsible for us to say, in light of that, let's send it back again. At that point, the ball has been passed to the court. And I think that's exactly what's happened here. In Hamdan, the Supreme Court debated exactly the question we're facing today, which is the historical situation with respect to conspiracy. Congress then acted. At Justice Kennedy's request and in response to the court's decision, Congress acted and now has sent it back to the court. I don't think in that situation that as a matter of constitutional avoidance that the court can avoid then the ex post facto question.
I wasn't asking you about constitutional avoidance. I was essentially asking you whether we even need to resort to it given the language in the statute. This chapter does not establish new crimes.
times.
So, Your Honor, I guess I view that a little differently than the court does. I view that as Congress's determination, that as Congress's consideration of the very ex post facto questions the defendant is raising here, and doing so in response to the send back from the court, and that I view what Congress has done as essentially legislating to the extent of the ex post facto clause. I don't think that as a matter of statutory construction or as constitutional avoidance, it is right to say that what Congress was doing was saying that we, if this raises difficult questions about ex post facto, or if, in fact, we're wrong about our view of the history, that we don't expect the statute to reach that. I view what Congress was saying is we have seen the debate, the very historical debate we're happening from the court, and we are weighing in as we have been requested to do and as we should want them to do. And at that point, it's the responsibility of this court, then, to decide the ex post facto question.
You agree that the ex post facto clause applies, correct?
We do, Your Honor.
Okay, so you get to the same result either way, correct?
So,
In terms of the legal principles that govern, it still boils down to the question of whether this was a crime at the time of the conduct.
So, Your Honor, it does, yes, Your Honor. We think that the ex post facto question is the question about whether is very much the same, and indeed, I mean, a lot of the ground was plowed in Your Honor's Hamdan II decision. The question is, looking backward, we think, a plain error standard, to go to Judge Griffith's question, under a plain error standard, did it violate the ex post facto clause in light of the long history and in light of the regulations, including the Army Field Manual, which from 1956...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the ex post facto clause question just then turns on whether the law of war in 821, what that means and how that applies to this history, correct?
I think it depends, Your Honor. Yes, but I think it depends principally on the question of what that history that we've laid out means and what kind of notice it gave. Now, the critical backdrop, it seems to me, for the ex post facto clause analysis, and it's something that Judge Brown alluded to, is that the backdrop, unlike a statute with elements that's the normal sort of meat and potatoes of ex post facto law, the backdrop here is an evolving common law system. And what Kieran said is that Congress in 821 had its choice of whether to codify something in particular statutes or whether to adopt an evolving common law system, and it chose the latter. It chose not to crystallize. And I think that that affects the ex post facto analysis. And I think it does because there is an inherent, there's an evolving nature to a common law court, which I think is important for the ex post facto analysis. The other thing I would say in the ex post facto analysis, to get back to my earlier discussion with Judge Garland, Chief Judge Garland, is that is that the standard that the court applied, the plurality applied in Hamdan, is not the right standard here. What Justice Stevens said was we need plain and unambiguous history. But that standard that he chose was driven in part because the military was acting unilaterally. And what Justice Stevens said was we're particularly worried in that context about concentrating power in the military. Here, of course, Congress has acted and has acted in response in part to Justice Kennedy's, and I think speculate that was shared by the rest of the court, a request that Congress weigh in. And I think that changes the analysis in at least two ways. First, I think when this court looks at the history, this court is the ultimate arbiter of the ex post facto clause, but when this court looks at the history, it should give due deference to the political branch's judgment that this history shows that the conspiracy is triable in a military commission. And second, I think it changes the standard. It should not be the plain and unambiguous standard, although I believe we meet that with respect to conspiracy. But that should not be the test. That test is derived from a situation in which the executive...
About the legislative history. So you say they thought it was clear that these crimes could have been prosecuted. Again, looking at the legislative history, this time from the report from 2006 of the Committee on Armed Services. The committee firmly believes, so at least they have a firm belief about this, that trials for crimes that occurred before the date of the enactment of this chapter might be prosecuted with this subchapter. That doesn't sound like they were clear that these could be prosecuted backwards.
So, Your Honor, I don't have the full context, and as Your Honor's earlier questioning, I think, suggested, there might be different levels of firmness depending on the crime that was at issue.
Yes, yes.
And so we've conceded, I think, that although we believe that material support has direct analogs, but the conspiracy is really the much stronger case, and I think that that is the kind of belief we're talking about. I also think, Your Honor, though, with respect to that directly, that 950P is the governing statement. This is a very unusual statute, as Your Honor is aware, that where we have Congress not relying on the kind of legislative history that Your Honor discussed to decide what Congress's belief was with respect to the firmness of its belief and things of that nature. 950P says what Congress thought, and what the language Congress chose does not have wiggle room or indecision. That's Congress's judgment. Now, again, we recognize
So your view about, since you're relying on that section, your view about the language, this chapter does not establish new crimes, your view is that means Congress has made that judgment, that this statute, in fact, doesn't. It's a declarative statement. It's not something that that we build into our analysis at all. Is that your point?
So I believe it is a declarative statement, Your Honor, and I don't think you can build it into your analysis if that means the way the Hamdan 2 panel saw it, that if you disagree with the premise, then you construe the legislation more narrowly. Mm-hmm. I think fairly read, what that sentence is weighing in on the very question that Congress responsibly understood was at issue, and some of the discussion
Congress,
that...
Suppose we think Congress was wrong. I mean, let's assume it's not even clear that they're just wrong.
So I think
there is no basis for conspiracy having been traditionally tried. I'm just they're completely wrong.
So Your Honor,
let's assume you agree with it. I know you don't. Would we still ignore this language?
So Your Honor, I think what happens at that point is you ignore the language and we lose. But I don't think you can use it as a matter of constitutional avoidance.
I didn't hear the word constitutional avoidance pass my lips.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was talking about the statute.
I'm not looking at the statute.
That's all. And so let's assume my hypothetical is that Congress is flat out wrong. There's no evidence at all that that conspiracy was traditionally tried before a military commission. Now what do we do?
I think that Your Honor then has to, I recognize that we disagree with that, obviously, but what Your Honor's, the response to Your Honor's question is that you would then have to construe the statute as reaching the prior conduct and hold it unconstitutional as applied to defendant because it violates the ex post facto clause. Well, and that's the step that I think Congress has put to this court. I think that's what the court said in
Boudin. But why would I have to, I don't mean to pursue, just give me a crisp, why would I need to invoke constitutional avoidance? Why, in my hypothetical, where it's absolutely clear that Congress was wrong about conspiracy, I would just take it at its word, and it says this chapter does not establish new crimes. Congress thought it was an old crime. They were wrong, and therefore it's triable only prospectively. Why do I have to go beyond the language to do that?
So, Your Honor, I think because of the provisions that Judge Griffith pointed to earlier, and I guess part of it is I read 950P differently than Your Honor. I read that as a discussion of precisely the question that's at issue in the ex post facto analysis. And second, I read it precisely because of 948D. And part of it, Your Honor, is this notion, I think, of dialogue. If Your Honor were to adopt that approach to the statute, mm-hmm. the response would be that we'd be back in Congress's court to say, no, Your Honor, we really meant it, all right? We don't care whether we were right or wrong. We meant this to apply retroactively. And I don't think 12 years on after 9/11 that is a sensible approach for this court to take. I think that this court needs to resolve the question, and we're all dealing with the same question that has troubled the court since Hamdan. All right. So there isn't anything left to be gained by sending back to Congress and having them volley back to this court. I think the time for it's fish or cut bait time, Your Honor, is the way I would say it.
Can I ask you about the standard of review? You raised the plain error standard. Which arguments do you think are covered by the plain error standard?
So we think, Your Honor, the ex post facto question is covered by plain
which
error.
Which argument about ex post facto, whether it applies in Guantanamo or whether this would be an ex post facto violation?
The latter. We've conceded that it applies, and so I don't think we are arguing that that's reviewable at plain error or otherwise.
And the reason that the argument is subject to plain error was because it wasn't raised by Baluo before the trial court, right?
Correct.
But he also didn't raise the retroactivity argument, did he, or did he?
He did not, Your Honor.
So why don't you argue that that's forfeit?
Your Honor, it's a fair question. I guess we would say that that we just haven't chosen. I guess in this instance we have waived waiver, as it were.
Right. So I'm just wondering. So you would, of course, if you did say that was forfeited, you wouldn't be able to overturn Hamdan II, because all you would get would be an argument that a decision by this court either was forfeited or not. So is this is it fair to pick and choose which of the arguments he didn't raise are forfeited and which ones aren't forfeited?
So I'm not sure how to answer that, Your Honor. It is correct that I take, at least I perhaps misunderstand Your Honor's question, but as I take it, the question is, part, are we going to get any guidance from Your Honor if this goes off on plain error review?
And particularly if the question of whether the statute on its face applies retroactively, that's the decision you want to challenge.
Right.
But if we say we're only going to say, well, it's not plain error that it didn't, that wouldn't necessarily apply in the next case.
Yeah, I recognize that, Your Honor. And I guess I would say two things. First of all, we believe we have a conviction here of a defendant that is charged with very serious conduct, including being bin Laden's personal secretary, arranging for two 9/11 hijackers to swear by that, preparing murders wills. And so I think we would want that conviction affirmed. Second, I would say on plain error, the way, of course, we would prefer the court to resolve the plain error analysis to find there was no error at all.
Yeah. So plain error analysis comes from Rule 52, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there is no Rule 52 applicable here.
No, Your Honor. And I think it's a fair question when we struggle with. I think we view the kind of plain error analysis as sort of inherent in the court's review dating back to cases like Yakis v. United States that would apply essentially, that plain error has kind of been a part of judicial review in this court's analysis, in court's analysis, in the criminal context for quite some time.
So let me ask two questions about that. So one question is, while it is has been, both respect to civil and criminal review, something like plain error, something like forfeiture, some limitation on the standard of review, that's not the case in the military system. The military appellate courts, as intermediate military appellate court ruled here, they have plenary review. And so why don't we apply, since this is the standard that's going up here, why don't we have plenary review?
So, Your Honor, I may be misunderstanding the military review, but my understanding was that there is certainly, there are notions of waiver and forfeiture that do apply in the military context, and that although the Court of Military Commission Review chose not to apply it here, that in fact those principles were settled, and that although a court certainly can continue to review the question, that RMC 905 has a sort of contemporaneous objection requirement, that that's something that the military courts in fact do enforce, and then have a sort of plain error review. But anyway, I do think once it gets to
the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has said that they have the authority, and the immediate appellate courts in the criminal area have the authority to waive the waiver themselves, which is something that we don't always have the authority to do, and it's particularly for following Rule 52. But so in this case, we have a situation in which the appellate court did decide the question, right?
It did, Your Honor, yes.
And when that happens, our rule is that we don't apply our normal forfeiture rule. That is, so we have our own case, Blackman-Malloy, which says that although we normally won't consider a forfeiture without exceptional circumstances, we will consider it if the district court actually decided the question. And Judge McConnell, in a case in the Tenth Circuit under Rule 52, says the same thing. Well, yes, normally we're going to apply plain error. If the court below decided the question de novo, then we can decide it de novo. Isn't it different here because there was actually a decision by the court below us?
So, Your Honor, I confess I'm not familiar with those cases, but I believe it's been the government's position that at least under Rule 52, that the fact, for example, that a court of appeals addresses a question on the merits would not prevent us from arguing, for example, in the Supreme Court, that Rule 52 limits review to plain error. And so I would say that the fact that we still continue to believe that as that the proper approach for this court is plain error, especially since what the court below found was not that there wasn't forfeiture, but that it didn't need to reach it because it ruled against the defendant on the ex post facto clause violation.
I'm sorry. I understood after Hamdan, too, that you told the panel that the conviction had to be, that this conviction could not stand under Hamdan, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So, and that seemed to be a waiver of any waiver arguments in how you, what you told the panel. In this case, after Hamdan 2 came out, and then in the in-bank petition, it also didn't raise this issue. So we granted it, at least my understanding was we granted it without that issue.
So, Your Honor, my understanding of the way the en banc works, and obviously Your Honors are in a better position than I, is that all of the issues, you don't waive or not waive, that the entire case comes before the court.
Right. I understand that. But to the panel, you did say after Hamdan 2 that Hamdan 2 required ruling against the government on the case.
So, Your Honor, I think that our critical concern with respect to these cases is that the court's conspiracy ruling has effect across a wide range of cases. The five cases that have been resolved by guilty plea all had conspiracy and or material support. Four of the five had conspiracy. The five cases that have been charged against the 9/11 defendants, all of them have conspiracy. As a result of the Hamdan 2 decision, there has been a motion filed by the defendants in the 9/11 cases to dismiss all of the charges. Now, we are contesting that, but they are arguing that in light of Hamdan 2, none of the charges can be brought. The conspiracy decision is having an impact.
There are lots of charges other than conspiracy in those cases, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and we've moved to dismiss all of those on the basis of Hamdan 2. Now, we're fighting that.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we're not at all conceding that those are meritorious. But that's the kind of uncertainty that the Hamdan 2 decision has caused.
Was this a consequence here of the court or of the government deciding to make charges like conspiracy rather than aiding and abetting?
So, Your Honor, I don't think, I mean, certainly there's a lot of charging discretion, but I don't think that that can fairly be described the way Your Honor has for a couple of reasons. First of all, Congress itself said that conspiracy is triable. And so we are reacting as prosecutors in part in response to that congressional judgment and our own judgment about what's appropriate. Second, there's no doubt that conspiracy is a critical at least an omnipresent charge, and that it is important to prosecutors as a tool to be able to handle these cases. And so,
so are you saying you couldn't have charged aiding and abetting or criminal enterprise or anything like that here?
I'm definitely not saying that, Your Honor. So, and I think if you know, we need to go back and think about.
Why weren't they charged? I mean, this in a way it looks like this is a test case. You know, we're going to try to go as far to the evolving in nature of the common law of war as we can and see how that comes out. That's not the court's fault that leads to uncertainty.
So, Your Honor, I guess I would say a couple of things to that. First of all, I don't think there's any suggestion at all that this is a test case. There have been five previous cases, all of which that pled in the Hamdan case as well, so at least six, where conspiracy is brought. This is not a situation where the government is setting up a test case.
I'm not saying it's improper to set up a test case. I'm just saying if you do, you may end up with uncertainty, that's all.
But I don't think that is what we're doing, Your Honor. I think we are making our judgments as prosecutors about the best way to make this case. And so, again, if the Hamdan 2 decision were to stand, we would need to go back to the drawing board on a couple of these cases and consider aiding and abetting or JCE or some other form of liability. But I don't want to minimize the impact of conspiracy. And I do think the second point, Your Honor, is it would be, although we would disagree with it strenuously, there's a difference between adopting Justice Stevens' view of the history and doing what the Hamdan II court said, which was to basically render that history, from our perspective, largely irrelevant. And so I think when you look at the history, and when you look at, and you do so under the proper standard, and you see the kinds of cases we're talking about, and you see the Lincoln conspirators, and you see Wirtz and Grenfell, and you see Kolpaugh and Kieran, and then you see the post-war orders, and you see what's striking to me is the absence of any question actually in the American experience, in the experience of our wars, that of a suggestion that conspiracy couldn't be tried.
Can I ask really just a factual question? Your opposing counsel took issue with the characterization that perhaps they had forfeited the ex post facto clause case and said that there was a colloquy before the military commission. What is your response to that?
We read that colloquy very different, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're talking about the colloquy where he says what I did was not a crime. But I think in context what he's saying is that that's because I was fighting for Al-Qaeda. This is the transcript 167 and 175. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm quoting from the brief of the United States at page 14. And what he says was, I said that I was of Al-Qaeda and I did these actions. Of course I said not guilty. Correct. I'm not guilty and what I did was not a crime. But in your point of view, I'm a criminal, but I'm not a criminal. I don't view that as the kind of specific objection to the idea that this couldn't be made a crime under the ex post facto clause. I view that more as a...
How does the presiding judge interpret what he said? That's what I thought the critical issue was.
So, Your Honor, what I understood the presiding judge to have said is that it preserved questions going to jurisdiction, and we don't view the ex post facto clause analysis as going to jurisdiction, and that there are cases in the sentencing context and others where the court...
So he didn't say legal and jurisdictional?
I don't recall, but what we view, Your Honor, is what he was saying was you have preserved jurisdictional objections, but not others.
So, go ahead.
No, no, please.
In terms of your comment about the impact of the decision, I'm sure you're going to agree with this, but there are three things that can still happen: detention for the duration of hostilities, charges for pre-2006 conduct for all the other crimes that were rooted in international law, and charges for post-2006 conduct, including conspiracy. At least that's my view. So this is significant, but as a practical matter, it's not a release order.
We agree, Your Honor, it's not a release order. As the prosecutors in this case, in these cases, are wrestling with exactly what to do in the wake of Hamdan II. But I don't want to take your Honor's point. I don't want to either minimize or understate the impact. I mean, this is not a release order, but this has caused a great deal of uncertainty. The 9/11.
What meant to disclose this impact supposed to have on our construction of statutes and Supreme Court opinions?
So, Your Honor, I think that you should be looking at the history and practice of the United States and the whether things are triable under the law of war in military commissions.
Yeah. Has nothing to do with that.
I think if you look at that history, Your Honor, that history requires the decision that there is no ex post facto violation.
I ask then, if you're worried about impact and you're worried about uncertainty, wouldn't it be better for you to waive the waiver if there were one? Because otherwise, you're not going to get a decision on that question if we were to agree with you.
So, Your Honor, I take Your Honor's point, and we are balancing two different judgments here. The desire to get a decision.
You want to live with some uncertainty as long as it goes your way.
We have a conviction. Certainly, we would love clarity in our favor, Your Honor. But I also have a conviction of somebody who is convicted of a serious crime, and I think that conviction should be affirmed. Well, we think it should be affirmed on the ground that there is no ex post facto violation. But certainly, we don't think any ex post facto violation rises to the level of plain error.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right. Thank you very much.
Your Honor.
How much time is left?
18 minutes.
It's all yours, Mr. Paradis.
I think I would start with a point my friend made a few minutes ago, which was that conspiracy is their strongest case. And I think our point is that conspiracy is actually their weakest case, because not only are they confronted, as this court was confronted in Hamdan 2, with an absence of good authority that would make this offense recognizable and articulable, certainly not plain and unambiguous, certainly not defined, definite, mandatory, obligatory, universal, all the standards ordinarily applied to customary international law violations. It's been firmly rejected at every turn by the United States. And I think the Nuremberg precedent is obviously very clear on that. But more importantly, our own military commissions after World War II, where prosecutors did bring charges for conspiracy, and to be sure, the prosecutors brought that charge, but the judges, American judges, military judges, consistently rejected inchoate conspiracy, conspiracy as a standalone offense, however you want to phrase it, saying, if you can prove a joint criminal enterprise for a specific act, okay, but we're not going to let you just charge everyone with conspiracy. And it's understandable that the government wants to charge conspiracy. We understand that. It's very easy to prove. But from a law of war perspective, that's precisely the problem, because what happens with conspiracy prosecutions, particularly in military tribunals, particularly where the juries are members of the armed forces, particularly where the defendant then is an enemy, who members of the armed forces are trained to hate. It is okay to hate your enemy under the law of war.
Do you dispute the history that your opponent recites, that conspiracy was, in fact, a triable offense, going back the days of the Civil War, or do you dispute the legal relevance of it in light of Hamdan and Article and its construction of Article 21?
We certainly dispute the latter, but we do dispute the former as well. My friend was referencing the Grenfell case. I think Grenfell is actually a very interesting case because there's a 120-page argument. I don't believe it's in the record, but it is cited in a law review article that we included in our reply brief, the David Glazier article, where the government argues for 120 pages why martial law governs this case. Because during the Civil War, the government's biggest problem is that the entire country, by virtue of the government's position, was under martial law. And so it didn't really matter to them how the jurisdiction went out in the wash, because the government thought, well, Ohio is under martial law, Indiana is under martial law. And so every citation they point to at least is confounded by martial law. But I think there are only two examples that we have found where the courts were able to disentangle martial law, what was authorized by martial law, from the law of war. And that's Ex parte Milligan, and that's In re Murphy. And in both cases, conspiracy was charged. And in both cases, the Supreme Court, in the Milligan case, and then Justice Miller, deciding Murphy on habeas corpus, said, because there was no martial law here, the military tribunal had no jurisdiction over the offender or the offense. And so if there was this other law of war, this substantive American law of war that somehow existed independent from international law and somehow derived jurisdiction from anything other than martial law, we would expect, if there was this doctrine, that would have applied there, and it would have been very convenient in not overturning two very serious crimes.
Does it make any difference, do you think, in looking at conspiracy, whether you're talking about a situation where you simply have agreement and an overt act, or where you have agreement and an overt act and the what the agreement conspired to do actually occurs? Does that make any difference to your analysis?
To the offense of conspiracy, no. International law, and this is, the position of the United States government, international law rejects conspiracy, the criminalization of an agreement, full stop. What may be left over is that if you're charged with a substantive crime, the government may be able to get there on a conspiracy-like theory of liability, which is called joint criminal enterprise in international law, but it's very similar to conspiracy. The government may be able to prove you guilty of a crime, but they're not proving you guilty of a conspiracy, just as the government doesn't prove you guilty of aiding and abetting. They prove you guilty of torture, of murder, of perfidy, and get there by virtue of aiding and abetting. And an if I could just say, that's they mentioned that the 9/11 defendants, the actual individuals charged in the 9/11 case, moved to dismiss by virtue of Hamdan II. In fact, the motion to dismiss conspiracy came from the chief prosecutor, who made this precise argument and relied on all the same authorities we're relying on, indeed some of their my friend's authorities, for the proposition that conspiracy as a standalone offense is not in the law.
So in your view, then, even if something like 9/11 had happened in 2009 and we had a detainee who had been involved to the same extent that Al-Bulul is involved here, we still could not charge conspiracy.
As a matter of international law, no. You wouldn't have an ex post facto problem.
I understand. That would go away. But in your view, we still would not have something triable before a military commission.
Well, in that case, even prospectively, there are very serious questions that we've raised regarding the Article 3 and Fifth and Sixth Amendment issues that arise with just Article
1. You wouldn't have a statutory problem. The statute says conspiracy. Trials, there's no problem.
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. We wouldn't have a statutory problem or a retroactivity problem. There may be a grand jury problem or an Article 3 problem, but that's...
But not a statutory problem.
Not a statutory problem, that's correct. But that is a separate problem. We've raised that problem, but that is separate and distinct from the ex post.
Well, I was asking something else, because the statute does say that, but I also understood one of the arguments to be that Congress's power to define crimes is limited by this idea of the law of war. So my question really went to if conspiracy is still not considered a crime against the law of war, then can we nevertheless try someone because it would go outside of that?
Prospectively, does that understand your question? The Supreme Court has certainly cast doubt on that question. Ex parte hearing has a very specific and clear discussion of crimes that are triable by the military because they're not they were basically triable by the military at the time of the founding, and they distinguish that from other crimes which must be tried by jury. And the court's analysis in looking at that was to say crimes that arise under what the court said was that branch of international law governing the law of war, a phrase they actually took from the Libra Code, those were not triable in a military court at the time of the founding, they were triable in a military court at the time of the founding, and so they remain so today.
Your position in this case doesn't rest on that prospective argument.
No, it doesn't. We think the simpler...
Prospective argument's inconsistent with the spying and aiding the enemy statutes. So I guess your position would be those would be unconstitutional to try those offenses in military commissions.
No, we wouldn't, Your Honor. Spying and aiding the enemy, and that was actually the Supreme Court's paradigm case in ex parte hearing, were made triable by the military in 1776 at the request, I should point out, of George Washington.
They're not recognized international law.
I think not today. I think during the 19th century, and even really up through this court's decision in ex parte hearing, they were viewed as war crimes. The court holds as much.
We're probably three steps removed. I just want to be clear. Your prospective argument, which I know you hold, doesn't affect your retroactive argument.
No, it doesn't. The prospective argument only, the issues arising in the prospective argument only become relevant if this court finds, for whatever reason, there's no ex post facto problem. I think so.
One last question for me. Suppose the history is, as the government says, the American history. What then?
I'm not entirely sure what the government says the American history is.
The government says that there's a long, consistent history of trying conspiracy in military commissions in American practice, and the fact that it's not recognized by international authorities should not overwhelm our interpretation of the phrase law of war in 821, given that American practice and given what Congress in 1916 and 1950 would have understood.
Then I would just say the government's wrong, and it's wrong for the simple reason that the Supreme Court authoritatively interpreted law of war in Article 15 and then Article 21 as only being offenses under international law. If you give me a moment.
On page...
On page 14 of In Re Yamashita, which I may have just lost my bookmark to. But yes, the court refers to the offense in Yamashita as an offense that is offenses that are recognized in international law as violations of the law of war. That's an intuitive interpretation of the law of war. Again, the whole point of the law of war is to have a common set of understanding and principles that differentiate what is and what is not allowed in such an extreme situation as war, that we want some clarity there and we want universality there. So to the extent the government's making the argument that, well, as they have conceded, that, well, it doesn't apply under international law, but it should apply under domestic law, just is inconsistent with the decisions of the Supreme Court. And I would also say the findings of Congress, because remember, Congress reenacted Article 21, or reenacted Article 15 as Article 21. Ordinary presumptions of, statutory history, legislative history suggest that when the legislature adopts a statute without change, it incorporates judicial interpretations of that statute. And here we need not just rely on that assumption. That's in the legislative history repeatedly.
Well, let me ask you about the legislative history. The government asks us to focus on 950P. P as in Peter. And the legislative history, this is, the House report that everybody's referring to, says that this list of offenses tracks those provided for under Department of Defense Military Commission Instruction Number 2, April 30, 2003, which is based upon international treaties and U.S. criminal law. Then it goes on, end of quote, then it goes on to say that you can try retroactively for violations. So is it your position, just so I'm clear, that this Department of Defense instruction did not include inchoate conspiracy?
Well, it did include a conspiracy offense that I think largely is tracked in the 2006 Act. There may be differences that one could point to. But I think most importantly is that even in the Military Commission Instruction Number 2, which is what the Congress is referring to, conspiracy was actually not included in the section on war crimes. It was included in a section called Other Offenses and Theories of Liability, which pertain to just a number of different issues. So even the prior administration didn't think that this was a war crime as we traditionally understood that. I think they just took a very different view of how broadly they could exercise jurisdiction when the Supreme Court rejected in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. And so I think unless there are further questions, I would just go back to the basic point of that there was no law that Mr. Ballou could have looked to know that these three things were crimes. And that confronts in a very significant way not just issues of fair notice, because I know the government has spent, a considerable amount of time trying to say, well, he should have known what he was doing was wrong. But laws aren't just moral sentiments. They are crimes. There is an offense. If you're told that if you do X, Y, and Z, you will be guilty of crime A. And here, there is no law Mr. Ballou could have looked to know what he was doing was illegal. And that's a problem that's not just to him because he's my client, but it also is relevant to our own armed forces. Because if I'm a commander and I'm launching an attack into a village, I'm going to ask my judge advocate, what can and can't I do? And that judge advocate is not going to go to the National Archives and divine a U.S. common law of war. He's going to say, well, international law lets you do this and doesn't let you do this. And that is what I'm going to use to determine what risks I'm going to take, when I can and can't shoot. And so the idea that international law somehow becomes parochialized by a U.S. common law of war because Mr. Ballou is a bad guy is fundamentally inconsistent with the purposes the law of war is to serve. It violates fair notice, any notion of fair notice, really. And ultimately, it confronts the principle of legality that is far beyond fair notice, far beyond what a bad guy it is, but the idea that the government must abide by its own rules. And that principle of legality is recognized the world around. It is central to the law of war, and it has been a part of our criminal law in this country for well over 200 years. And so because his conviction violates that principle, because none of the crimes with which he was charged were crimes when he's alleged to have committed them, we ask that this court vacate the judgment below.
Further questions?
Case is submitted. Thank you.